This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of the Amusement Warehouse Podcast. We're very excited today to have industry legend. What did you write down your superlatives I'm supposed to call you, Tim?
Yeah. You should have an email on that one.
Tim O'Brien knows everything amusement park. I know when I first got in the industry, I would read his columns in AB and get fortunate to talk to him once in a while and just learn so much about the industry. So I'm real interested to talk to him today about how he got started, what he's doing, what he's been doing, and a little bit, learn a lot about the history of amusement parks and how they developed. Tim, welcome.
Well, thank you, Ron. I love the intro. That's classy stuff.
Wow. Been practicing it. Well, you wrote it.
Yeah, there you go.
I was just kidding Tim off air. We were talking for a minute, but in his video, he did an interview with the USA Today, and the guy said, "What should I call you?" And he kind of tongue-in-cheek said, "Amusement park expert." And then the guy printed it. So he said ever since then, he's been the amusement park expert.
Yeah. That's well, once it was in print, you can't pull it back.
That's right. It's true too. Absolutely. No question about it. So getting into the amusement park, when you were a little boy, you were rowing or canoeing on a lake and got a job at a putt-putt green at an amusement park. That's kind of how it all started. Your interest anyway.
Yeah, well, you've done your research. I see that. I was born and raised on Buckeye Lake in Ohio, just east of Columbus. And we had a year-round home out there. And so I was a year-round rat. And we were right across a lake from the Buckeye Lake Amusement Park. So I would lay in bed at night, and you could hear the screams on the roller coaster. And I kind of got into my blood at a very early age. And then when I got about, 12, 13 years old, I had an old town rowboat, old wooden rowboat. And so what I would do is I'd row that thing across the lake, tie it up on the bottom of the roller coaster, climb over a couple of fences and go into the park. And it was a free admission park, so I wasn't sneaking in. I was just conformative as far as getting in. But I would walk around and, you know, got into my blood tremendously. And one day I asked I love playing mini golf. So I asked the lady, I said, do you have any jobs available? And she says, "Well, no, you're kind of young to work, blah, blah, blah." Well, turned out, she says, "I'll tell you what, if you come in the morning and you sweep all of our little greens, get the leaves off, you can play all the golf you want for free until the first customers come." I went, "Good deal." So I did that for most of that summer, got a lot of rounds of golf in because it wasn't a very popular attraction at the park. And so I got to know her quite well. And then I got to know some of the ride operators. So I got to ride the rides, and so it was a good deal for a little kid, you know, living across the lake from all that stuff. And
absolutely.
Then later I ended up taking, she also ran the Crystal Swimming Pool. And so she ended up being my boss for pay because I got a job working as a lifeguard at that pool for several years. And once I got my Red Cross certification, and that was a lot of fun. I got it totally into my blood, not the journalism aspect, not the photography, but just the whole concept of being around these swirling dervishes of color and kinetic energy. And it was just something that took over.
Yeah, it does get in your blood. There's no question about it. And then, of course, you went to school. Was it Michigan? No, I'm just kidding.
Where's the off button here? Let me push.
My son actually.
By the way, we call it Michigan. That team.
The Ohio State University.
That's right.
We majored in journalism, and then and you saw an ad for AB or for,
A lot of water went under the bridge before then. I got my undergraduate as well as my graduate degrees in broadcast journalism, film production. And what really got me, I think, because from the time I left Buckeye Lake until I went to college, I had very little interaction with any of the amusement industry at all. And what I did is when I went off to college, by that time, I was really into photography. I hurt myself playing football in my freshman year in high school and couldn't play anymore. And I met the school photographer who was graduating. He says, "Hey, do you want to be a photographer for the school? There's nobody here to replace me when I graduate." So he taught me photography. And for 4 years, I was a photographer for high school and started shooting weddings and whatever I could do between classes and so forth. And then I got a job at the Ohio State Fair for the summer of 67 and 68, and I was the entertainment photographer. So I was in the midfield of the track, and I would shoot all the acts that were there. And so I got to know, and there was a lot of free time between acts. I'd go out and walk around, and I befriended Milt Kaufman, who had good amusement at the Ohio State Fair. And he was my first introduction, a wild one. I later found out, him in his green and pink suits. But
Vicuna. Vicuna. He used to buy Vicuna suits.
Oh, is that what they were?
Yeah. I went shopping with him one time, actually, for his suits, me and Duke Trombetti. I don't know why. We were doing something with him, and he went to this place. I think it was in Virginia, like Richmond, Virginia, where he buys them. I couldn't afford even like a pant leg of it, but they were expensive suits.
Or would you wear those colors probably? Well,
that's true too.
But he took me under his arm. I mean, he was here's this wireless kid, and here's this very important businessman in the entertainment industry. So, and I got to know him well and took a lot of photos, and he bought a lot of photos that I was taking. You know, at that time, not everybody wasn't a photographer. Everything was on film, no video, no phones and so forth. So I was able to experiment with a lot of fun stuff and stuff that I knew that he would end up liking and buying from me. So and that really got me working with him. And so from then on, I started just really taking pictures anywhere I could. I got involved in American Coaster Enthusiasts. Because I loved roller coasters, so I would go to parks across the country and so forth. Worked several publications in Columbus and then went to New York and was a publisher and editor of a history and antique magazine for 6 years out on Long Island. And again, that's with Coney Island and everything there. Everything just really got excited within me and being a journalist. And then, one day we were deciding, my wife and I at that time, we had one daughter and decided, hey, being out here on Long Island is pretty expensive for a journalist payroll. So I said, let me look around. And I saw an ad in the editor and publisher. It was a trade magazine for the journalistic trade at that particular time. And I saw it and three months later, I was hired at Amusement Business in Nashville. So they were looking for a number two man behind Tom Powell, who was a legendary himself, but he had been sick and they were wondering, wow, something happens to Tom, what are we going to do? We need a backup. So I got hired to be managing editor, and that opened a whole new thing for me, being around this 24/7, going out and covering all aspects of it in an official capacity as a journalist. I guess the long story short on that was about 3 years into being a managing editor and general manager of the publication, I said, you know, I don't like this. I am not a good people manager. And I realized I climbed to the top of that corporate ladder as far as management and said, this ain't for me. I got to be out in the field. I got to be out interviewing people. I got to be taking pictures. I got to be traveling all over the world like all these other reporters were, that I had to assign these jobs. And I think the big break came when we had never covered the Oktoberfest in Munich. And so the publisher says, you know, let's send the reporter over there for a week. And so, and I had to go through three reporters, and none of them wanted to go.
Really?
Yeah. I go, well, one, I'd never traveled internationally, I'm afraid. Well, one thing led to another. I went to the publisher, and I says, you know, I'll do it. I want to do it. And he says, okay, well, get your regular jobs covered or scheduled, and you can go. So I came back after that. That was in 88. And I came back from that, and a couple of weeks later, I sat down with the publisher and says, you know, I want to be a reporter. I don't, you know, send me out there and let me be a reporter. I don't want to be in management anymore. So with my, you know, layout skills and so forth, they just didn't want me to do that. So we came up with a little, hybrid job for me. So I'd still lay the book out every week, and I'd do most of the editing. But I'd also report and record and photograph. We all had to take our own pictures. So, you know, photography was beneficial, my background in that. The book continued on. We were having a lot of fun, and it was a good run. I got to travel a lot and got to meet some really cool people. And I met my wife as a reporter, the lady I'm still married to, Kathleen. I married her. She was a PR person at the local Performing Arts Center, and there was nobody on staff that was available to do a story that needed to be done at the Performing Arts Center. So I said, I'll do it. So I went over and I met her. I interviewed her, and 6 years later, we got married. So that was kind of fun. So I took a lot of good stuff out of there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But you really, your passion was for amusement parks side of that. I mean, you guys covered everything. Obviously you had amusement parks and carnivals and fairs and all that stuff, but you really, amusement parks were really your
sweet spot. I was, and as a matter of fact, I was a senior editor of amusement parks. Amusement and theme parks. I think that was my title. It's so long ago. I was responsible for filling the pages every week of that section. And other people were responsible for filling other sections. So we had an editor in each of the same. And mine was amusement parks. And then it all depended on advertising. If there was a lot of ads for amusement parks, related ride manufacturers and so forth, we would have a big section that week on amusement parks. If there was a big talent section, you know, the venues, whatever, carnivals, like around Gibbtown and around the spring seasons, there would be a lot of ads in carnivals. So we kind of had to slide from one way to the other. And you know, each week, there was only three of us, I think, at the most, at any one time as a reporter. And sometimes we'd fill a 60, 70, 80 page magazine every week. And so I think the minimum that we ever really needed to do, maybe 7 or 8 stories each every week. And, you know, journalists who work for dailies who might have to do one story every 2 weeks, just we had a rough time keeping journalists because, okay, here are your assignment for this week. What? That's 8 stories. What do you mean? I can't do that. He says, yeah, you can. And it was kind of baffling. you know, and so people who were there were real workhorses, and we really got to know and feel comfortable in all facets of the areas in which we covered.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover in the industry. There's no question about it. I was just doing a interview and I read a book about the history of Conklin shows. I've been reading history, but, you know, Amusement Business and Billboard before that, I was thinking about like the, you know, early on before your time, the 20s, 30s, 40s, what a big role it played, because that's how people corresponded, was through Billboard and AB. And it was, I was just thinking now, the guy was just saying something and I was thinking in my modern head, but then I was like, well, how would you now, you know, how would you get the word out for so that they would write AB or they'd get their mail through Billboard or whatever else? It was such a big vehicle to communicate back then. It was the only vehicle.
A lot of people never knew, especially later on into the 90s and so forth, that Amusement Business used to be Billboard. And since 1896 in Cincinnati, It was founded. And so Billboard covered originally just bill posters for circuses and then carnivals. And that it's kind of grew from there. And it was the only publication out there that really covered this particular aspect of the entertainment industry. And so then through the years, they would do carnivals. Then when amusement parks, as mom and pop places started, they were called fun spots in the paper at that time. And the arenas and stadiums. And the big thing that Billboard had was, even though they had nothing to do with billboards, they picked up the radio and the recording industries. Right. So in the 20s and 30s, as you were saying, there might be 25, 30 page ads of RCA Records new releases. And so this jockeys would subscribe to Billboard to read about the newest newest recordings, the new artists. So it was, by the time it was in the 30s and 40s, that was a weekly publication that was anywhere between maybe 80 and 120, 130 pages long. It's just, I look back now and say, I don't see how they did it. And it was, but it was a Bible. And
it really was, yeah.
And the, what you were saying about the letters, it was quite unique because they got special, basically, dispensation from the government saying for the itinerant workmen, we were allowed to forward their mail. So if somebody wanted to get, Jim Jones, a guy that's traveling with a certain carnival or whatever, they wouldn't know where he was or how they would be able to reach him. They would send a letter to, what was it called? I guess, I forget. There was a special name for it. But to us, and then every week while we'd post, we have mail for, and then put the names of the people underneath of it who had mail waiting at us. And they would either call us or whatever and say, you can forward it to so-and-so. So we had the legality that we could just go ahead and forward it with no additional postage to these people with a new address on it. And it was, like you say, it was a pipeline. I mean,
it was unbelievable. And there were offices all over the country at one time too, for Billboard anyway, that people would they go to the New York office and they talk to blah, blah, blah. I was like, wow, that was a far flung publication at the time, I guess.
Yeah, it was, headquarters were in Nashville, and the there was a New York office and a Cincinnati office and a Chicago office and an LA office at one time.
When you were there? How many offices were there by then? Had it contracted?
We just had Nashville, New York, and Chicago and LA. Yeah.
Wow.
So we had a reporter, West Coast editor in California, East Coast editor in New York, and then the Midwest editor in Chicago. And then we ran it all out of, put it together, and all management was down in Nashville, which was a great place to live for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's you know, somebody should actually write a history of the importance of Billboard and Amusement Business on the industry, because it's like people don't realize, you know, what that it was such a pipeline. I mean, they couldn't have existed at least as well as they did without that communication and that help they got from.
Yeah. right now, I mean, it would be impossible to put out a publication like Amusement Business.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're a business to business trade magazine, and it was written for management, but it also had other stuff that, the guys working games or the rides and so forth would enjoy. And as a matter of fact, they got so important. There's always help wanted ads in the back. And a lot of, when I was there, a lot of carnivals, a lot of owners of carnivals would not allow us to sell the magazine on the midway of their show, because their people would see it and all say, oh, I'm going to jump. I want to be in California. Right. So I can jump the show and go to a show in Cal. So they ended up, a lot of people would not allow us to, because at one time we would send virtually every carnival that was running, or circus even, what we would do is just send out a bundle of papers every week to them.
And get an agent on the shows.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And then the carnies would know, every Friday or every Monday, whenever, I can go and spend $1 and get my Amusement Business, or as they called it, the billboard.
The billboard.
And then, and I mean, even to the, I left there in 04, and before that, I bet you, even going into the late 90s, people would say, oh, the billboard. And they quit calling us Amusement Business. We were always the billboard to the old time guys. And
yeah,
it's a lot of history, lots of history in that. And, you can go down a rabbit hole really quick by reading the 1950s even. By 1959, that magazine was so thick, the advertising was getting so expensive, because what carnival wants to help wanted ad, or a ride manufacturer wants it, when most of the readership was in the film or music industries. To be more wise and to be more efficient, we split. There was an indoor billboard and an outdoor billboard.
And oh, is that how it was designated or delineated, I guess, indoor and outdoor?
That's what kind of was the delineation when we originally split. Still owned, we weren't sold. I mean, we're still owned by the billboard company.
And that was around 1960, I think it split, or 60?
59 for the first time. And it just came out with it just as a small, like 8.5 by 11 sheet called Fun Spot, trying to differentiate, delineate the two publications. And then through growth, it became Amusement Business, which was more instead of Fun Spot, because we covered other fairs and carnivals and circuses and everything. So it was like that. And it was interesting because we should have kept the name Billboard, and the new publication should have been called something else.
Yeah, but music from what industry. I hear,
but what
music industry or something like that.
It's something like that, because it was heavy in the music and records, and the charts had already started by then.
Right,
the music,
that was the big thing.
And so we thought, I wasn't a part of it, but from what I understand, everybody said, well, the outdoor industry is not going to survive. Why would people want to go to an amusement park or a carnival, or even outside in the old hot weather? They want to sit at home and watch television, listen to music. Outdoor industry is dead. It's going to die. So why give the publication that's associated with the outdoor industry to an industry that's going to fold up, and then we'll lose the name Billboard? So that's the reason we got several names before we became Amusement Business.
And now the music industry is pretty much dead in a lot of ways, or at least changed radically. And
yeah, that's far from dead, but it's changed immensely is a good word for it.
As it was covered before, album sales, things like that. So you love parks. You started covering parks. How many parks would you visit a year when you were doing your when you were in your editorship?
In my prime?
Prime?
Yes. God, I don't know. 25 or 30, maybe.
Wow.
And what was fun is that people, I had several job offers to go to work for parks in PR, marketing type of stuff through the years. And I would say, why would I want to do that and limit myself to one park when I can visit 25 or 30 years? So that's the reason I never went over to the dark side. And it depended a lot. Because especially during the 90s, when Six Flags started buying up all the small mom and pop shops, and Six Flags was very, very sensitive at that time. The management was very sensitive about it. So they pretty much told their managers of these parks that they were buying, okay, you know, we're buying this, you're going to stay manager, but you can't talk to amusement business. So we heard that a lot. So that kind of limited us for a while until things came over and the paranoia was gone and we were able to start reporting it. So we had to end up really being real reporters. I mean, instead of going out and talking to the general manager for a couple hours and getting all the scoop, we had to kind of go behind their backs and find out information. So that was kind of a fun, challenging time. And especially every year, I was responsible to put together the year in attendance charts. And the first several, which were quoted. I mean, New York Times, LA Times, Time Magazine, they were all waiting every year until that chart came out.
Right.
So that they could talk about the big leaders of the year and all this. And so that's like you started the thing about me being quoted as an expert. That was when I was mostly interviewed. I spent most of my days just talking to other media for 3 or 4 days. But that was very good publicity for amusement business as well.
But when we do top 50 fairs now too with the attendance, and that always gets big, you know, you're surprised where it's picked up, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
It's funny because I was just talking about the other day with Matt about doing amusement park numbers, and I was looking at it a little bit and I was like, how do they even derive the numbers now? Because they don't announce them pretty much. I mean, you know, I have an MBA and I can go through a financial report pretty well, but even there, it's kind of buried. I was looking at a couple and I'm like, it's not easy to discern. And so unless they tell you, or you can back into it somehow, it's not an easy thing to do. And then I listened to your little clip the other day about numbers and I said, aha. So they used to just give them to you. And now then they became more and more reticent to give them to you.
Well, it all started, you know, when I started the charts, I started doing the charts. I did every year's attendance chart from 88 up to 2003. And by the time I got into the late 90s, I had it down pretty pat on how to do it. Mm-hmm. But originally, you know, you would call the park up. Okay, what was your attendance? Boom, boom. Well, what was the season? Blah, blah. Yeah, and you'd walk away after 10, 15 parks a day, and it would take you 2 or 3 days to put this thing together. But what happened was when Eisner took over Disney, he started, he came from the theater, or the Paramount, where he was, of the movies. And he said, we're not giving out attendance on a weekly basis anymore, like we have to do in the movie industry, because I don't want to live and die by my weekly attendance. And so he quit giving weekly attendance. And then by the end of the year, he decided, well, we're not going to release our yearly attendance either. And that was, and then the other park said, well, if they're not going to, we're not going to. And Cedar Point would do the same thing. And Kings Island would do the same thing. And it got down to the point that only Knoebels would give me attendance figures every year. So it was a 2-3-4 week journey, and it was actually all year because I had to keep my eyes open and ears open, because let's say a marketing person from Disney would talk to the stockholders or whatever. He would talk about figures, and there were clues often in there where the numbers were going to end up. And so I really had to be on top of things with that. And it was so funny because I would call people and I says, guess what? It's that time of year again. And they said, oh, I dread this call every year, Tip. And it got down to the point where Disney would neither give me a number, but they would confirm it. And so what I would do is a top level Disney official at each park would sit down with me after I would come in with a number and say, okay, here's the number I've got for you guys this year. And they said, all right, what do you think about it? And I said, well, because you did this, this, and this, it seems reasonable. So you're giving us a 6% increase, huh? I says, yeah. He says, I think that might be a little too aggressive. I said, maybe 5. He says, I said, 3. No, that's a little low. And so I play these games. And so I came up with really, really close numbers. A lot of Disney marketing people who didn't know I was doing this with top management would say, yeah, this scares me how close your guesses are every year. And so it was fun.
It'd be easier if you just told me.
Yeah, right. I could enjoy my holidays because this was always between Thanksgiving and Christmas where these, because our year-end issue would come out with these numbers every year and the week before Christmas. And, you know, and at the IAPA show, I'd walk down with Busch Parks when they had so many parks and were combined with SeaWorld and all this. I had somebody in that organization too. And, who said once, he said he can't be seen with me because the numbers are so close when I come out, he would get in trouble because people would know the leak. So what we'd do is just walk down the aisle and he'd be with a bunch of Busch people and he'd shake my hand. He says, nice to see you again, Tim. And he'd keep walking and I'd walk away with a piece of paper in my hand with all the numbers and things like that. That was, it was a lot of fun. And it got a lot of attention for amusement business while it lasted.
Absolutely. So it stopped in 2003 or you stopped it in 2003?
I stopped. Okay. I resigned in early November that year, 2003. But I said I would stay until I got the numbers out because it would have been really unfair because I was the only one doing numbers and I hadn't started numbers for that year. So I decided that it would really be unfair to this publication I love to leave and let them out stranded without getting the numbers. So I stuck around for that. And I was a lame duck. So I had a lot of fun those last 2 months. And that's when I decided to go with Ripley's to get out of that. And then AB ended up folding, I think, 3 years later because there were so many
changes. Did they do it after you left or no?
I'm sorry?
Did they do it again after you left or was that too big of a task to recreate the whole thing?
I don't know. I don't remember. I would have thought I would remember if they did it, but they changed format. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons I left because I saw the writing on the wall. It wasn't going to be the old amusement business anymore. They were going to go to monthly, but more of a feature publication. And you can't be a monthly news magazine even back then. And I mean,
no, and they were printed too, which made it slower. I remember we first started putting out articles, you know, we were all online. So I was like, we could put it on our article every day if we want, you know, so we don't have to wait. And that was the big turn. Of course, now we're printing too. So we went backwards, but you could see the industry was changing and so many people are sort of already have the old business model. They're already geared up for a certain thing. So it's tough to go to move and be nimble and move backwards. So that's really fascinating.
Absolutely.
So of these parks, what are some of your favorite, but you wrote a book about the sort of the amusement industry pioneers of the parks, who are some of the most fascinating park owners and why do you think they made such a big impact on the industry?
Oh, wow. That's a good question, Ron.
From you, that means a lot. Thank you.
Very, very, very good. Let me go aside a little bit here. I was on the IAPA Hall of Fame committee. And from 91, 92, I think they started the Hall of Fame. And then I was on the committee up for about 10 years. And one of our criteria for to be in the Hall of Fame for IAPA is that there was a whole list of criteria, but the main ones is not what you have done for your own park or for your own company, but what you did, how did it affect the industry worldwide? Because the Hall of Fame is not about these little people who run this wonderful little amusement park out in the middle of nowhere. And excuse me a second, let me shut my phone off. Potential spam. sorry about that. But what we had to look for the whole, the big picture. And a lot of people thought, hey, I should be, or they should be in the Hall of Fame because look how they've, this, look at this park, how successful it is. And we make so much money every year and we have a million attendants and so forth. Well, yeah, congratulations. Good for you and good for your family. But what did you do for the in the international amusement industry? And that was a big criteria. So that kind of goes back to the question you asked, who I felt was the most influential in the earlier days of the theme park industry. And my answer would go back to, like, I love Stan Nelson out in Wichita. He was very friendly guy, ran an amazing park, very cordial. I could always count on him for a quote if I needed one. And I also, being Central Ohio, I went north. Cedar Point was my home park, I considered it. And a lot of very good people up there. And Dick Kinzel, again, took me under his wing, I guess you could say, and was very kind to me and always found time for me and always took my phone calls. And that's when he ran the just the Cedar Fair parks. Then, of course, they bought the Paramount parks later. But back when it was just Cedar Point, I learned a lot from Dick about how to deal with people. And he would take a walk every day from his office, and he'd walk through every section of that park, Cedar Point. And he would say hi to people, and they'd say, "Hi, Mr. Kinzel. Hi. Oh, hi, Bill. Hey, Mr. Kinzel." You know, he seemed to know everybody's name. He would go up on the roller coaster platform, the riding platform, and just stand there and talk to the operators and greeted people as they would walk by. And it was real interesting to see him, how he dealt with people. And I kind of judged all my other interviews and all my other general managers and people that I talked with at parks on what Dick did. And so he was very, very influential, I felt. And other people, guess again, some of the names I can't even remember, but the Disney PR and marketing staff was always very, very good to me. And again, you know, we at one time, up until the time that Amusement Today came out with Gary Slade, we were the only publication, a full-time publication just for the industry. And I was the only full-time employee as a journalist that covered the industry full-time. There were a lot of the European publications, but they were like a monthly or every other week type of thing. But the journalists there would also be working for other publications and so forth. And so at one time, I was it. And then as other publications built up, you know, and it wasn't because I was so good. It was the fact that I was the last remainder of a old time journalist who went over into trade publications. So it was, I learned an awful lot. And, you know, like when Tom Powell, probably most of your viewers remember Tom Powell, or at least heard of Tom. He was our larger than life carnival editor who just knew everybody. And it was so funny when I went out to start doing carnival interviews or going out to fairs and wanted to, I'd go up to this. I'd like to talk with so-and-so, general manager of the park, the fair, of the carnival, of the show, or whatever. And they would say, "Well, just a minute." And what, unbeknownst to me, what they would do is get on the phone. This was the first couple of years, and call Tom and say, "Hey, okay. There's Tim O'Brien out here that wants to talk to you. Is he okay?" And I'd say, "Yeah, okay. So come on in, Tim." And then, you know, once I got Tom's blessing, that I was in. But he was so thought so highly of in the industry, as he should have been. I mean, the guy was he was a hard-nosed journalist, which was really good. And so, you know, and I learned a lot from Tom as well. But I think what I did in the theme park industry was I would try to get in to see the general manager. And oftentimes the general manager wasn't available, type of thing. So what I did was I set out specifically to make contact with middle management people, like the marketing manager or operations manager or whatever, and got to make my contact in the park and got to know these type of people. A lot of marketing people moved up into the top management back then. And so I'd make friends with all these middle management people, and they would trust me and feel good around me. And then when they got moved to the top because the other people retired or left the park, these guys took over. And I already had an in at that time. So it took me about 5 or 6 years to really get a good footing into the trust factor. And, you know, I got a, you know, I gave a speech at one time and said, thanked everybody for allowing me into their parks because they accepted me. I came in and I'd sit down and have lunch with them at in the mess hall or whatever. And it was fun. I felt like a person within the industry at that point.
Right. Accepted.
Except which is dangerous because I wasn't. And I had to be careful that when I was being interviewed or I talked to other reporters for other publications, I had to be real careful not to be a cheerleader for the industry because that would just take away everything. So if there was an accident or whatever, I would get calls all the time from media. Well, what happened? How did you see? And so a lot of the parks, when they would have an accident or have an event, like a riot or a ride accident or whatever, one of their calls after they figured out what was going on was to me saying, you know, we had a death this afternoon because of this, this, and this or whatever. You know, here's what happened. So when I got calls, I would know what was going on. I wouldn't have to speculate. And again, that won me a lot of friendship within the industry. And I wouldn't say, rah, rah, oh, that's a bunch of crap. That's not real. I had to be a third party observer, both for the industry and for the general public. And I had
an honest broker, sort of.
Yeah, yeah. And that was another fun part of the job, you know, getting to talk to so many people and feeling trust. And, you know, one person who, and God, I'm not going to give his name, but I could have just really buried a lot of people in the early 2000s in the industry, because this one person, I'm not even going to tell you if he was a park person or a manufacturer, was dying. And this person called me up and said, Tim, here's what I'm going to do. And he says, I'm going to send you some tapes of what's really going on in this industry. And he says, you do with them whatever you want. And he says, and once I'm dead, you can use my name. I don't care. And I listened to those tapes and I sat there aghast at some of the stories he told me on these tapes. And I didn't do anything because, you know, my job was not to decide which guys are good, which guys are bad in the end. I'm gonna try to be a journalist and try to keep a middle ground and try to stay non-biased. But if I were ever to write a tell-all book, I mean, I could have just rewrote what he said and had a bestseller probably, and also been run out of town.
Exactly. You be sensitive with the information that you have. You know, it's funny for fairs. One time I thought about, it's like, I wonder what the pay scale is. And you can look up pretty easily and find out what, you know, the manager of some of these big fairs make. And at one time I was like, I wonder if I should publish a list of salaries of all the And I said, I'll probably be running the industry. Maybe some people will be happy. I don't know. But, you know, you got to be sort of thoughtful and careful about what information you're putting out there and whether it's fair or not, really, to put it out there or not.
Yeah, you really do. And a lot of them are state or city employees. So, yeah, they had to make that record. But only people locally would know how much they were making. And I'm sure a fair manager on the West Coast makes a lot more money than a fair manager in North Dakota. So, I mean, if they had
Texas, these things, you want to be in Texas if you're making money.
Yeah, really. So, yeah, that was smart not to release that. Yeah, we learned that over years as a journalist, what you can and can't say and what you want to say as opposed to what you really do say. But that was
whether or not you'll be able to hold your head up at the convention and not be run out of the, the room.
Yeah, and that was always a payback. You always kind of saw how you were doing at the conventions every year. Gibtown as well as IAPA, because people would stop and talk to you. Hey, we take my picture. Hey, you'll never guess what took place. And what was really funny, there's three or four people every year at IAPA would see me and they say, hey, Tim, I've got this great story for you. So I'd call them and they'd give me a nice story and I'd take pictures. And then they wouldn't talk to me the rest of the convention. They were just really friendly and caught up with me at the beginning. But as soon as they got done what they needed done, they went on to their other cronies. And I knew that. I knew that was happening. You know, I'd be walking down the aisle and I would hear this guy's voice and say, oh, God, here we go again. But I'd always get one good story out of them a year. So that was kind of nice.
So what are some of your favorite parks to visit over the years? Like, which ones do you really think? I know I'm fascinated myself a little bit with Holiday World. I visited them once not too long ago. I thought, you know, free parking, free drinks, free sunscreen, great little park, family owned and all that stuff. I've always thought that's a great park. And, you know, I grew up, when I first grew up, I was really young, but Palisades Park was open and then it closed, but that was a great park at one time. But what are some of your favorites to visit and or at least even in the past, you know, before they were bought out or whatever?
Yeah, well, Cedar Point was my home park.
That's a good park.
By the time I got to college, Buckeye Lake Park, the one that I grew up in and really knew well, was gone. They turned it into a state park and tore down everything. So Cedar Point was always very, very much on my scope as it was like an hour and a half to 2 hours from Columbus where we live. And so as I was growing up, I did that. In fact, I did an hour documentary film on Cedar Point as my part of my master's program at Ohio State. And again, I learned a lot about the industry back then. And that was even before I knew that I was going to, you know, go into this industry, which was kind of fun. But I look back at the narrative on that, and it is so naive, I guess you could call it, how I positioned Cedar Point and so forth. But Cedar Point definitely was on my map right from the beginning. And, you know, the first park I took Kathleen to when we got married was Cedar Point. And trying to turn her into a coaster freak like myself. And she was okay with it. But then by that time, I was getting to the point that I could only take two or three loops. I couldn't do these five, six loops things. But Cedar Point, you mentioned Holiday World. Yeah. Will Koch, and myself, you know, we became friends right from the beginning. And when Will was running the park, he'd call me up a lot of times and say, well, what's the industry thinking about this or how's this? And so he really wanted to stay attuned and keep this little, which was Santa Claus Land. And then they changed it to Holiday World. And started putting in themed areas like Halloween and so forth. And he called me up and he says, hey, listen, will you guys come up this weekend? I got some questions. I want to walk around the park with you and ask you some stuff. And I said, yeah, cool. So we went up and he's okay, we're thinking about putting in this big wooden coaster. And but let me walk around and show you what we're going to do with it. So we walked the track and or the path that they were going to put the coaster and so forth. And he said, we start here and then we go through the tunnel and we go over the little lake and then we'll end up, and it's going to be in Halloween area and people will come out and on and on and on. And so he was asking me, what do you think about this element? This is never, we've never done this element at the park. And one thing led to another. And he says, okay, now he says, what do you think we should call it? And I went, that's a good question. He says, that's, why not, since you're going to be in the amusement park or in the Halloween area, why don't you call it like the Edgar Allan Poe? Or something like it. No, better still. He says, call it the Raven, and then your slug line can be Nevermore, Nevermore. And he loved it. And he ended up naming it the Raven. And I even have a big, I think his the NAPFA, the Historical Society for Theme Parks, actually put a plaque naming me as the person who helped Will name it. So that was kind of fun. And that's so they always held, I always held a very big part of my heart for them because it was a family operation. I mean, they were doing fantastic. So I would say definitely Holiday World would be up there. And I also liked, believe it or not, I really liked the Houston Astro World Park.
Oh, okay.
There was something about that park that just was really, again, was not one of the more popular Six Flags parks, but it was always a good one. And then I think probably other than Cedar Point, the park that I liked to visit the most was Busch Gardens in Williamsburg. I mean, that is
where I live.
Beautiful park, beautiful.
Yeah, it is beautiful. I mean, there's no question. It's a hike though. If you're not in halfway decent shape, you're not going to make it through that park with all the hills and valleys and every place else. It's an incredible place. What do you think about the coast parks, the boardwalk parks? Are you a fan of those? Yeah.
Very much so. Very much so. I love the little trolley parks around the country. Still a lot of them are on my mom and pop. And I love the seaside parks. That's Maurice Piers, for example, in Wildwood. They do it right. And they have fun doing it. They know that they're part. And, you know, they're all free admission because people on the boardwalk aren't going to pay a dollar to walk through a
park. Right.
So, I love the feel of an ocean park, coastal.
I just
park.
Interviewed Joel Golder from up by you in Maine. He was fascinating to talk to with his park and his family and all that stuff.
Yeah, it's not, his isn't right on the coast, but it's right in the beach town, which gives it a lot of fun to it. But yeah, I mean, we summer up in Maine, as you know, and the Old Orchard Beach is just fantastic. And then the fun world's water world in Saco, again, that's another family organization that runs that park. So it's fun. It's a fun, fun town, water town.
So yeah, I was watching your video and I feel the same way. You kind of lamented the corporatization of parks, which has become so prevalent nowadays, was, you know, you kind of, it was kind of like the carnival industry still is, where there were, you know, there was a guy and he owned it and he was involved with it and he'd be out there, you know, varying degrees of success or whatever, but he was the guy, or, you know, they were the family that ran it. And the boardwalk parks are still that way. And the trolley parks, like you're talking about, they're still the Knoebels and the places of the world like that, but those are less than they used to be. And now you get either corporate ownership, sometimes government ownership, but it's just not the same when it's like that, right?
No, absolutely not. When you switch from making sure people have fun to switching to the bottom line, making sure we make money, that's when you put the focus on the bottom line as opposed to on the guest, that will ruin the park. You have to find a good balance between the two. And a lot of people don't, you know, like, good example, that's when that new ownership took over Six Flags last year. They changed the park so much in order to get the, you know, they had to, because they were not making money and they had to end up creating a new environment for guests because guests weren't happy. And so it was a big mess, and but they had to do it. And now I think with the ownership changing and part of being part of the Cedar Fair organization, they're going to learn a lot about how to do this. The Cedar Fair people took over the top parts of this new whole Six Flags organization. And that's gonna really direct this. And, you know, 4, 5, 6 years, those parks are going to be dynamite as far as attractions and money-making machines again.
Yeah, but how they run it and how they treat their customers is the other part of that makes it really tough with even when you're covering your parks, like we cover parks, and I get like some of our reporters, I get story pitches or whatever, and you know, I kind of shy away from the bigger parks because it's just not that interesting because you're just getting canned stuff that everybody already kind of knows. I want to know about the guy who, you know, what he's doing different or bought the thing over there. So we try to focus more on the smaller parks. You can't ignore the bigger parks, obviously, but you know, even when you're interviewing ride manufacturers, you know, they won't tell you anything, you know, and because I mean, I can get a little bit tids and bits out of them, but most of the time they're like, well, they're scared to death of the parks saying, whereas, you know, the carnivals and the smaller parks, they're celebrating what they're buying. They're excited about it, want to talk about it, but you know, why it's got to be such a secret, I'm not really sure, especially with the trade publication, you know, I don't get it.
Yeah. Well, I can't tell you how many times that, you know, I heard, okay, this manufacturer's creating this ride and they're going to sell it to Cedar Point next year. So I talked to my contact at that manufacturer and say, hey, I heard blah, blah, blah. And he says, Tim, why should I tell this to you? Because you're going to turn around and tell everybody else.
Yep.
You know, good point. That's exactly what I'm going to do. That's why I'm asking you. But luckily, and I know that's not a lot of journalists today like to do this, but a lot of times they'll say, look, off the record. So I can prepare for next spring when this ride opens and do a little background and be able to treat you both well. Tell me what's going on. And, you know, I'd say 80, 90% of the time, by the time I left the industry, they trusted me enough knowing that they could talk to me off the record. But I said, okay, well, I'll keep it off the record. When you're going to announce it, you let me know a week in advance so that I can make sure our publication comes out on the day of or immediately around the grand opening announcement so that I don't look like I'm reacting. I want to be proactive, but I'll keep your secret for a while. And it works.
There are a lot, especially the corporate park, this just came to my mind. I think they're a lot more concerned, and it draws parallels with what you said about IAAPA too in the Hall of Fame. They're more concerned about the customer. So they'd be more inclined to talk about, you know, sort of outward industry facing news rather than, you know, a trade publication like us or like AB certainly was, because they, you know, they don't see any benefit in it. They want to just get the information out for their customer.
Absolutely. And that I realize has to be done, because I'm not, you know, when I come to their park, I don't pay to get in. I don't pay to ride. So why do they waste it on me when they should be promoting it? And like you said earlier, especially from the larger parks, you don't get a lot of FaceTime with the people who can answer questions. What you do is get press releases and you get statements, and that kind of, and you can tell the publications that run, you know, I'll pick up a press release that somebody sends me, and I'll see another publication running it word for word. They don't do their own report. They just believe whatever's on the press release. And that's one thing that we weren't allowed to do, or nor did we want to do at Amusement Business, is, okay, here's a press release that gives you the idea. Now rip up the press release, get out there and get your own story. And that was kind of like our attitude there. That's one of the reasons I think we were so well respected right up to the bitter end.
Absolutely, because you did journalism. You did real journalism and looked at stuff.
Imagine that.
So much bright. Well, it gets harder when that's all you get is a press release. So does make it difficult. Tim, I can't believe it, but we've been talking for like an hour already, believe it or not.
We haven't
touched on anything. Not anything. We touched on a lot, but we haven't dredge the whole depth of what's going on out there.
You said we'd have 6 hours. What are you talking about?
I think we could. I mean, there's certainly some people you can. I'd love to have you back periodically to talk about parks and things, because it's just fascinating to talk to you, and you're such a wealth of knowledge. And
well, get me when my memory is still here.
Yeah. And do you keep up with it now a little bit? Do you know what's going on currently?
Very little. You don't have, you know, I know what most other people read. I have no contacts left in the amusement industry. Maybe one
I
or two.
I doubt that's still. True.
You know, they know of me because they've got articles and stuff in their files with all the stories I've written over the years.
Books? Where can they get your book, by the way, if anybody's listening? Where can they buy your books? Amazon?
Everything's on Amazon, right. And I've gotten away from all the park stuff and now starting to write about roadside fun attraction stuff. Roadside attractions, you know, the world's largest chair, you know, stuff like that. And I'm loving every minute of it.
That's awesome. Well, Tim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hang on 1 second. I'll talk to you after we're off for a second, but we're going to play our outro and go from there. Thank you so much for coming on.
This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing. Is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.